I can't believe you asked me that.
You know what I mean?
Sunday school.
I asked him what he was talking about and why. I didn't get any reasonable answer, of course, but he continued on with his story. I was stunned and also embarrassed. So here's this mother. She's in a store, and her son is sharing with the shopkeeper that he's going to die on a Saturday and that he's going to a place where there is a blue barn, blue dogs, blue animals. My other two children, ages 7 and 13, also heard James. We finally just left the store. I'm sure the clerk thought we were a very strange group. I told his father that night. I was disturbed about James' story. Subsequently, James relayed a similar story 4 or 5 times to his father, and one more time, he relayed it to... Ah, my computer just crashed. Well, let's take care of that real quick. Here we go. He relayed it once more to me, although I didn't pay close attention to it. And isn't that the case with children? Oftentimes children will share with us experiences with angels or out-of-body experiences or deathbed visions or premonitions. And I see it all the time in my clinical practice. Yes, skeptics, I'm a clinical licensed therapist. And folks will come in and they'll bring their children in and children will be having deathbed visions and parents will be wondering if maybe it's the stress and it's just they've created an imaginary friend or if it's school stress. And then lo and behold, somebody in the family passes. Well, anyway, James died on December 18th, 2 minutes to midnight. He died in Children's Hospital in ICU, much to the surprise of those who cared for him that night. He had been sick with a fever and a small cough for 3 days before I had him diagnosed with pneumonia. The fourth day we were in the hospital for preventative measures, not life-saving ones. He had a turn for the worse around 9 p.m. on the 18th, and his heart stopped while they were intubating him for a ventilator. We await the results of the autopsy. The remarkable thing about this otherwise seemingly healthy child was that he died on a Saturday. He died on the Saturday after predicting his death. He had no fear when he described heaven to us and was not fearful of the idea of death. It was as if he were talking about going to the zoo or to school the next day. And that's what kids do. They're very matter-of-fact. We have been fortunate to have this gift, this story given to us so that when we have to tell others of our son's death, we also can tell them his story of heaven. It has been uplifting and brought hope to many here in the area. I know that the story has been repeated many times. The one thing we haven't been able to find is other parents who have experienced this type of event, and I will keep looking. Now, that's what my job is. When people email me these experiences, what my job is to validate, first of all, direct them towards reading material that's going to validate, and then to support groups where they can be with other parents who have had these experiences. Hope you enjoyed this story. I look forward to reading your book. If you can, point me toward any information that would be helpful to our family, and I would welcome it. James' mother. Is that incredible or what? I have encountered many individuals who are told by a loved one days, months, and even years before a passing when their actual physical death would occur. Can some of us predict our own upcoming physical death? The accounts I've received of cases just like this one sent to me by James's mother tell me again, yes. We would continue our discussion on premonitions because I think it's a fascinating topic, and we will continue it. But one of you guys sent me an email. So you took me out of control and you disrupted my flow, but it's a good thing. It's okay. The skeptics would say that this is just coincidental. But why are the skeptics so bent on pounding on DBVs, NDEs, OBEs, and ADCs? Okay, let's go ahead and let's look at an article which was published by a well-known card-carrying skeptic. This article was sent to me by one of you. And the reason why it was sent to you is because I'm all over it. One-time magician Joe Nickel, now the senior research fellow for PsyCops. Now, PsyCops, huge skeptical organization. If you watch any of the programs on television where they are debunking after-death communication, or they're debunking anything that has to do with the paranormal. If you read the credits, what you will see in the credits is psychops. Now, these folks, what's interesting about these folks is they're not really researchers. They're a bunch of folks who have come together, and their main purpose is to get a lot of media attention, to just to debunk those of us who are trying to really see what's going on in the world of the paranormal. But it stands for the Committee for the Scientific Investigation, and they don't investigate of claims of the paranormal. And they put out, it looks like they put out this article several years ago when my one book, One Last Hug Before One Last Hug, The Mystery and, oh boy, they just get me so upset, I can't even think straight. One Last Hug, when One Last Hug came out, obviously this guy reviewed it along with some other written material, and he put out this, it's called Investigative Files. If you go to the Skeptical Inquirer, just plug that in your website, they will have a section called Investigative Files, and this particular one is called Visitations, After Death, Contacts. And the guy starts out by saying, those who suffer the loss of a loved one may experience such anguish and emptiness that they are unable to let go. And they may come to believe that they have had some contact with the deceased. The author of My Search for the Afterlife, Dennis Spaulding, who manages an air traffic control tower at the Renton Airport, lost his son in a car accident in 1993. Now, Dennis emailed me a couple of weeks ago, so we have moved from what Joe Nickel was saying to talking a little bit about Dennis Spaulding. And he becomes aware of his son on a regular basis through after-death communication. This is a guy who wrote to me and he said, you know, after my son died, yes, I felt anguish and it was overwhelming and it was distressing, but then suddenly I began having these after-death communications. And what he did is he really looked into that. This was not a guy who knew about the New Age movement. This was not a guy who, from what I can gather, was into paranormal activity, which is very, very typical with a lot of parents who lose a child. They lose a child, and then they begin to have these clues. As he continued to communicate with his son, he recognized that life truly goes on after death, and that you don't always need a medium in your life to have special contact with your loved ones. Now, when I read through Dennis's website that he has put up for his son, and his website is Sean, SEAN39S-Corner, CORNER, and it's a website that's dedicated to his son. When I went through that website, I didn't see somebody who was working, really, really working to make something out of nothing. What I saw was some real, real, real evidence that his son has made contact with him. And what he says is, this site will also be used by my son and me to promote the publication of our spiritual story. Our hope is to inspire others to open up their own psychic and spiritual awareness to the possibilities and realizations that communication between our two worlds of existence can be achieved. Your loved ones are only a thought away. We can communicate with the other side. Now, what I want to say here is, this isn't a guy who went out and got an agent and put together a book so that he could become a best-selling author. This is someone who had a spiritually transformative experience with his deceased son. And it was so powerful for him and so overwhelming for him that it basically alleviated him of his anguish and reconnected him with his son. And so now what he wants to do is he wants to share it with other people. If you ever have one of those, wow, this was different moments in your life, don't let this special experience go by unnoticed. That's typically the response that people have when they make contact for the first time. It's like, whoa, where did this come from? ones are trying to get your attention, trying to warn or caution you. Then again, maybe they're just trying to say, hello, I'm here beside you. It will surely bring peace, comfort, and happiness in your loved ones to know that you are there and they have not been forgotten. It was such a good feeling to receive an unexpected sign. Listen to your mind and thoughts. They could be thoughts or messages provided by spirits of your family and friends. So, you know, Nichol, basically what he said in the article, the first thing he started doing is he started bashing signs that people report, these after-death communications, these signs that they get from their loved ones, which let them know that their loved ones are just a breath away, that physical death isn't the end, that life continues. It's commonly reported that the deceased person has communicated in some way, says the vice president of the Life Transition Center, either by giving a sign or causing things to happen with no rational experience. The Transition Center of Hospice Care Corporation is a community-based program that provides services throughout the North Central West Virginia. Services include, now these are people, hospice workers. The hospice workers are well aware. These are the people who sit with the dying, the skeptics. I would someday love to take a poll. I would love to take a poll of all of the members of PsyCop to find out exactly how many of these individuals have actually sat with somebody who is dying. How many of them have ever experienced an after-death communication? So here you have hospice, and what they do, they provide all of these wonderful variations of education and support groups and individual counseling for children and adults and referral services, and they go into the schools and they go into workplaces, and there's a children's grief camp, and the team of grief and loss professionals are there to help organizations. So, you know, on their site they print, it's not uncommon for these experiences to happen. The president states, it's equally common for people to wake in the middle of the night, lying in bed, or even to walk into a room and think that they have seen their husband or their child. These experiences are sometimes called visitations, and they include deathbed visions, Carla Wilfrand. So Nichol continues. So here we have all of this wonderful information about after-death communications from a man who has experienced a zillion of them and who has put up a website to share with other parents who are looking for places to go to get information, and then from a hospice group. And then Nichol, the skeptic, continues. During over 30 years of paranormal investigation, I have encountered countless claims of such direct contact. I have also occasionally been interviewed on the subject, most recently in response to some books promoting contact claims. Because the mainstream media called him up, he is an expert. Paranormal bashers for hire by the media. We'll talk more about this in a minute. I'll turn on one of these programs, just hoping that there will be friends of mine who are wonderful researchers who will be sharing their research regarding near-death experiences or after-death communications or out-of-body experiences or premonitions. Bona fide university researchers with lots of letters behind their names. And no, they don't. What they usually have is they have some poor person who probably really strongly believes in what they do in and may actually be gifted, but they present them in a clownish manner so that they end up looking foolish, and then they have one of these PsyCops guys come on and debunk the whole thing. It really does, it really ticks me off. Here is a look at the evidence regarding purported signs of dreams, apparitions, and deathbed visions. Well, I'm going to stop here for a moment. I was talking to a friend of mine today, Dr. Bruce Grayson, he is one of the founding members of IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and he continues to do an awful lot of research. He also is the editor for the professional journal for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And he and I were talking about this, and one of the things that we were talking about is we were talking about how these people, what they typically do is that they don't base their opinions on up-to-date research. And this is always very, very frustrating for those of us who are doing the research. Typically what they do is they express their opinions, or they grab an older piece of research, or what they do is they find, unfortunately, in every field, there are individuals who aren't real kosher, and our field isn't any different. And so what they will do is they will find somebody who really doesn't represent our field very well. And so as opposed to having the courage to debate one of us who really are into investigating and really into, we don't say that we know what's going on. I have never said, ever, that I know what happens after we die. What I have said time and time again is that there is something that happens, I don't know exactly what it is, and that we need to have more research in this area. But unfortunately, it's really hard for us to get research funding because the skeptics, unfortunately, are doing such a great job slamming all of us. So anyway, this guy continues in his article. He continues in his article, and he begins to really, really go into making fun of deathbed visions and after-death communications. He just blasts them, and it really is frustrating. So what he does, first of all, is he gets a hold of an author named Donna Thiessen, and I always pronounce her last name terribly. She actually contacted me when her book came out. This is another parent who she lost her son, and she really does believe that her son contacted her. And she talks about browsing in a gift shop, and she noticed a display of dollhouse furniture, and nearby on a small hutch there were a pair of tiny cups that were touching one another bearing the name Michael. And in the other words, on the other cup she saw, "I love you, Mom." And at that time she had a strange, warm feeling come over her. Now, when people have these experiences, what I need to share with you is that it can be the most benign, simple experience, but the emotions that accompany the experience are overwhelming and they imprint on us. I've talked to you about this. On the other hand, the fact that the two cups were displayed together out of dozens of others sold there convinced the author that the incident defied the odds. Soon she began looking for more strange occurrences so as to confirm that the cups incident was a real sign. Her book chronicles them and the experiences of other grieving parents, 44 of them, mothers, 40 to 44. One whose son was killed by a train was wondering whether to give his friends some of his baseball equipment when she heard a train whistle blow and accepted this as an affirmation. Okay, so here is this mother who is sitting here with her son's baseball equipment, and her son has been killed by a train. And she's wondering if she should pass on his baseball equipment to somebody else, and all of a sudden she hears a train whistle. And for her, it imprints, and that's an affirmation, yes. If that's true for her, that's true for her. And he goes on. Other receive signs in the form of a rainbow, television, telephone glitches, the arrival and sudden departure of pigeons, a moved angel doll, and other occurrences. Okay, see how he sort of makes fun? To explain such signs or meaningful coincidences, conjunctions of events that seem imbued with a mystical significance, psychologist Carl Jung theorized that in addition to the usual cause and effect relationship of events, there was a causal connecting principle. He termed it synchronicity. So, okay, this guy, he just hung himself right there. First of all, this guy hasn't done his homework. He uses Carl Jung's explanation of synchronicity to explain the after-death communications that these mothers are reporting. First of all, this guy doesn't know that Carl Jung had a full-blown near-death experience, and it's well documented. To just blow off after-death communications as synchronicity or, quote, a causal connecting principle, this writer, he really near-death experience because so many people don't know that he had this. In Switzerland in 1994, he had a heart attack, and he encountered a light, and he had some incredible experiences. He saw the Earth from a vantage point of about 1,000 miles above it. That means he had an out-of-body experience. His incredible accurate view of the Earth from outer space was described about 2 decades before astronauts in space first described it. Subsequently, as he reflected on life after death, Jung recalled the meditating Hindu from his near-death experience and read it as a parable of an archetype higher self, the God image within. Jung, who founded analytical centered psychology, basically got into discussing the collective unconscious. So basically what happened was he had this powerful near-death experience, and then what happened was he got into really getting into the spirituality of psychology. It seemed to me that I was high up in space. Far below, I saw the globe of the Earth bathed in a glorious blue light. I saw the deep blue sea and the continents far below my feet, and in the distance ahead of me, the subcontinent of India. My field of vision did not include the whole Earth, but its globe shape was plainly distinguishable, and its outline shone with a silvery gleam, but through that wonderful blue light. In many places, the globe seemed colored or spotted dark green like oxidized silver. Far away to the left lay a broad expanse, a reddish-yellow desert of Arabia. It was as though the silver of the earth had there assumed a reddish-gold hue. Then came the Red Sea. As far, far back as if the upper left of the map, I could just make out a bit of the Mediterranean. He's describing his view of Earth and identifying continents and oceans. My gaze was directed chiefly toward that. Everything else appeared indistinct. I could also see snow-covered Himalayas, but in that direction it was foggy or cloudy. I did not look to the right at all. I knew that I was on the point of departing from Earth. Later I discovered how high in space one would have to be to so extensively have such a view, approximately 1,000 miles. The sight of the Earth from this height was the most glorious thing I had ever seen. After contemplating it for a while, I turned around. I had been standing with my back to the Indian Ocean as if it were, and my face to the north. See how detailed this is? Then it seemed to me that I made a turn to the south. Something new entered my field of vision. A short distance away, I saw a space, a tremendous dark block of stone, like a meteorite. It was about the size of my house or even bigger, and it was floating in space. And I myself was floating in space. I had seen similar stones on the coast of the Gulf of Bengal. They were blocks of tawny granite, and some of them had been hollowed out into temples. My stone was one such gigantic dark block. An entrance led into a small antechamber. To the right of the entrance, a black Hindu sat silently in a lotus posture upon a stone bench. He wore a white gown, and I knew that he expected me. 2 steps led up to this antechamber, and inside on the left, he's so precise, was the gate to the temple. Innumerable tiny niches, each with a saucer-like concavity filled with coconut oil and small burning wicks, surrounded the door with a wreath of bright flames. I had actually seen a temple like this once. Now, of course, the skeptics would say that he's pulling all this from his mind, but what about the map of the globe that he's seeing out of his body that wasn't even available for decades? As I approached the steps leading up to the entrance into the rock, a strange thing happened. I had a feeling that everything was going to be sloughed away, everything I aimed at or wished for or thought, the whole phantasmagoria of earthly existence fell away and was stripped from me, an extremely painful process. Nevertheless, something remained. It was as if I now carried along with me everything I had ever experienced or done, everything that had happened around me. I might also say it was with me and I with it. I consisted of all that, so to speak. I consisted of my own history, and I felt with great certainty this is what I am. I am am this bundle of what has been and what has been accomplished. This experience gave me a feeling of extreme poverty, but at the same time of great fulfillment. There was no longer anything I wanted or desired. I existed in an objective form. I was what I had been and lived. At first, the sense of annihilation predominated, of having been stripped but suddenly that became of no consequence. Everything seemed to pass, to be passed. What remained was, without any reference, back to what had been. There was no longer any regret that something had dropped away or been taken away. So, you know, he goes through a grieving process, which is what near-death experiencers often discuss, is that they leave the physical, and there's a tad bit of grieving about leaving that behind. And then there's this sense of disconnection from that and this sense of relief and homecoming. On the contrary, I had everything that I was, and that was everything. Something else engaged my attention as I approached the temple. I had the certainty that I was about to enter an illuminated room and would meet there all those people to whom I belong in reality. There I would at last understand. This, too, was a certainty. What historical nexus I or my life filled into, I would know what had been before me, why I had come into being, and where my life was flowing. Stop in time, gang. My life as I lived it had seemed often to me like a story that had no beginning and end, and I had the feeling that I was a historical fragment, an excerpt for which the preceding and the succeeding text was missing. My life seemed to have been snipped out of a long chain of events, and many questions had remained unanswered. Why had it taken this course? Why had I brought these particular assumptions with me? What had I made of them? What will follow? While thinking over these matters, something else caught my attention. From below, from the direction of Europe, an image floated up. It was my doctor, or rather his likeness, framed by a golden chain or a golden laurel wreath, and I knew at once, oh, this is my doctor, of course, the one who has been treating me, but now he is coming in primal form. In life, he was the temporal embodiment. Now he is the temporal embodiment of primal form, which has existed from the beginning. Presumably, I, too, was in my primal form, so he's talking, in essence, of being in his soul. So this is something I did not observe, but simply took for granted. As he stood there before me, mute, we exchanged a thought. The doctor had been delegated by the earth to deliver a message to me to tell me there was a protest against my going away and that I had no right to leave and that I must return. The vision then ceased. It ceased. I was profoundly disappointed. Most near-death experiencers will share that they are depressed that they have to come back. So basically, he had this just awesome experience. And so here we have the skeptic talking about Jung, but unfortunately he didn't research his subject well enough to understand that his subject of discussion, who he was using to support his article, had actually had a near-death experience himself. Now, my friend Jeffrey Long has also been researching after-death communications for a long time, and this guy is a practicing cardiologist. And he has a website packed full of interesting information. So what Nichols says, some occurrences that are interpreted as signs probably have mundane explanations. Although unexplained, they are not unexplainable. For example, the mother of a severely handicapped little boy reported that on the morning of his funeral, she awoke to see a small glowing red light on the dresser where his baby monitor had been. It was, in fact, a tiny lantern on her keychain. It had never been turned on before, she says. In fact, I didn't even know it worked. The moment I touched the light, it went out. This happened for several subsequent mornings. How do we explain such a mystery? Well, personally, what I would say is that if you have an electrical appliance that hasn't worked, has never worked, and then suddenly, on the day of your son's funeral, it's sitting where his baby monitor used to be, and all of a sudden it comes on, I think that would get my attention. But what our skeptic says is one possibility is that the light was not turned on at all, but only appeared so as sunlight reflected off its red cover. Like, you see, I guess my problem with this guy is that he wasn't the mother who was there. He wasn't the mother who was in that room. He wasn't the mother who just happened to turn, wasn't really looking for anything, just happened to turn and see this. What my author friend is missing here is the emotional component to the experience. The after-death communication, according to Jeffrey Long, Dr. Jeffrey Long, the cardiologist and researcher, is a spontaneous contact or communication with a deceased friend or family member. ADC may include any of the following. The sensing of the presence of the deceased. The sensing, just the sensing. And the sensing is generally accompanied by an experience of joy and love. Seeing the deceased, which may involve seeing all or part of them clearly or incompletely. This author basically took one of my accounts out of my book, One Last Hug, and decided that it was not a worthy account because the experiencer only saw her deceased loved one from the waist up. Hearing the deceased, which may include one-way or two-way conversations. This conversation may be heard externally, as we hear in our everyday lives, or it may be heard internally. Feeling the deceased, which is usually described as a tap, a hug, a kiss, or a caress. The touch is generally described as typical of how the deceased used to lovingly touch the experiencer. So my grandmother, she used to always grab me by the shoulders and tell me to, you know, get my act together. When I had an after-death communication with my grandmother in dream form, she came to me in the dream, grabbed me by the shoulders, and told me to get over it. She said it was time for me to quit grieving about her. Smelling the deceased, usually described as a fragrance, aroma, or scent which is associated with the deceased. The smell of roses, the smell of lilacs, the smell of aftershave. What is clear is that the ADC is not, I repeat, not a hallucination or mental psychiatric dysfunction. They are real. ADC experiencers talk with generally with feelings about these experiences, and they will be significant and meaningful. ADC experiencers may have questions regarding their experience, yet usually have a deep sense that the experience was real for them. So for this guy just to downplay these experiences because he hasn't had one, number one, and number two, because he hasn't been really with someone who has had one, well, that's not scientific investigation. Okay, Carla, I have a story to share that occurred with the passing of my grandmother. She died around 3 a.m. according to the doctors. That night, before I knew she had died, I dreamed of her passing. I dreamt that I was driving home and passing by her house late at night when I had to stop to allow a funeral procession to pass in front of me. Interestingly, my cousin said that she woke up at 3 a.m. that night and stared at the clock. So you have a cousin waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You have a woman having a dream at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then you have a person dying at 3 o'clock in the morning. Most recently, I dreamt that the next-door neighbor had died. 2 weeks after the dream, he did, in fact, pass away. He was elderly but had been in fine health, and I had no reason to suspect his demise. This author went through in his article and discussed why dreams just are not pertinent to afterlife communication. Even an ordinary dream can be especially powerful when it involves after-death content. This is our skeptic again. And there are types of dreams that can be extremely vivid and seemingly real. According to paranormal and NDE debunker Susan Blackmore, who also has sat on the board of directors for the skeptical group PsyCops. This is a woman who, she is the one who always, she appears on these shows, and she is the debunker, and she has a PhD behind her name. And so she will say things like lucid dreams in which the dreamer is able to direct the dreaming, something like waking up in your dreams. So basically what she is saying is that these people who have had these after-death communications in the form of dream experiences or a pre-death experience, that it's just a lucid dream. Well, I think that this story right here, where we have a woman who lets us know that her grandmother died at 3 o'clock in the morning, that her cousin woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning at the exact time when her grandmother died, and that she, around that time, had a dream down past her house and having to stop in front of a funeral procession, that's a pretty interesting lucid dream. A powerful source of visitations is the so-called waking dream, which occurs in the twilight between wakefulness and sleep and combines features of both. Basically, what the skeptic goes on to say is that these experiences are just a byproduct of the hypnagogic experience. Well, for those of us who research these encounters, what's interesting is that during the hypnagogic state, yes, people do tend to have a lot of these experiences. I had, like lots of you out there, some of these experiences. He goes on to say that these sorts of dreams, according to a psychologist, Robert A. Baker, may just be related to a dreamer's current concerns. Now, we have talked about this. I have shared with you that, for the most part, what our dreams do is they keep us healthy. They allow us to discharge our anxiety. When we have problems during the day, we will dream about these problems in symbolic form in order to discharge anxiety. If we have trauma in our life, oftentimes our trauma will surface in the form of dreams. I had, like a lot of you folks out there, some really sad times in my youth. My mother, she died when I was really, really young. And it was extremely tragic. I mean, I was motherless, and for years I had dreams about coffins and cemeteries, and I had dreams about my mother getting out of her coffin. Were these ADCs? No, absolutely not. These were related to my trauma. The difference, the emotional content that was involved with the feelings related to the dreams about the coffins and the cemeteries and my mother getting out of her coffin, that was totally related to my unfinished business. They were related to unresolved trauma. ADC dreams, dream premonitions, precognitions, deathbed vision dreams are very different in content and feeling. I've experienced all of the above, and they are in no way, shape, or form similar to the tragic death-related dream material I suffered in my youth. So here he goes on again. He continues. So he continues to discuss dreams, and he talks about why dream material can't possibly at any time be related to contact with the other side. Then he goes on to deathbed visions. Another type of alleged visitation comes in the form of deathbed visions. According to Brad Steiger, who actually is a really good friend of mine, and he writes incredible books, that's Steiger, of course, the skeptic says, who endlessly cranks out books promoting paranormal claims, states, the paranormal of deathbed visions is as old as humankind, and such visitations of angels, light beings, previously deceased personalities, and the holy figures manifesting to those about to cross over to the other side have been recorded throughout all of history. Steiger goes on to praise writer and family grief counselor Carla Wills Brandon. Now, when the skeptics always want to discount people such as myself, they never say licensed clinical marriage and family therapist, licensed psychological. I mean, they don't give the right title for the researcher. They kind of like degrade a little bit. Not that there's nothing degrading about being a family grief counselor at all. So he takes a little stab at my book, my first book on departing visions. Like others before, Carla Wills Brandon, and then he aligns me with Kubler-Ross, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I'm in good company. Wills Brandon promotes deathbed visions largely through anecdotal accounts, which, as we have seen, are untrustworthy. Now, why is that so? Why would they be untrustworthy? Are they untrustworthy because he wasn't the one who collected them? He wasn't the one who experienced them? He wasn't the one who had the experience of witnessing them? There are individuals out there who do abuse, and they do put together books, and the books do contain information that I don't think is really reliable. But for him to just put down the book because of that, she asserts that the scientific community has great difficulty explaining a type of DBV in which the dying supposedly see people they believe are among the living, but who have actually died. She cites an old case. involving a Frenchman who passed. I'm going to give you the abbreviated version of this incredible departing vision. There was a man who was getting ready to pass in France, and this was in 1894. There, some of these incredibly rich, descriptive visions were collected by Dr. Barrett, who wrote a book just called Deathbed Visions, and they were based on experiences his wife, who was a surgeon, she was a physician, witnessed with her patients, but then the two of them continued to collect accounts. This one comes from a different source. If any of you are interested in that source, email me and I'll be glad to pass it on to you. But long abbreviated version of this experience is that this man was getting ready to die, and he suddenly called out the name of a friend of his that he hadn't seen in years. He hadn't seen this guy in years. And so he called out, he had a vision of his friend, and he said, "Ah, you too?" And then when the family returned home, they found a card announcing the friend's funeral. So why would this dying man cry out, "You too," to a vision of a friend he hadn't talked to in ages? Well, basically, the skeptics, of course, came up with all sorts of excuses, none of which made sense. They were very convoluted, and he basically questioned the maturity of the daughter who reported it. He questioned if the man was just so close to death that he was distraught, and that because he was so close to death, he was thinking about old friends. My question is, why can't we even ponder these visions? Why must we immediately buy into the idea that because a dying man is old, that instead of turning his thoughts to his family and saying goodbye to them, because he knows he's close to the end of his life, wanting to say his I love yous to his beloved son and daughter, that instead of doing that, in this account, his attention suddenly turns to some friend he hasn't seen in years? And then in the middle of all of this, he decides that since he has been out of touch with this friend for so long, that he must be dead? Am I crazy, or does this sound like a very complicated explanation by a skeptic? The skeptic, he just gave all sorts of curious explanations, that because the man who was dying was so close to death, he immediately thought that his friend, who he hadn't seen in a number of years, was dead too. It just seems convoluted to me. So he goes on to describe why departing visions just can't be anything significant that needs research at all. Susan Blackmore describes the NDE as an essentially physiological event prompted by lack of oxygen, the structure of the brain's visual cortex, and other factors. She recognizes that the experiences are hallucinations, seemingly exceedingly real, and she points out that one does not actually have to be near death to have such an experience, that many very similar experiences, I guess the DBV2, are recorded of people who have taken certain drugs, were extremely tired, or occasionally were just carrying on their ordinary activities. Many of the DBVs reported by Wills Brandon and others are similar to NDEs and are probably hallucinations produced by the brain. Okay, let's get this straight. We're running out of time. DBVs, deathbed visions, do not look like near-death experiences. There is a difference, but because the skeptics do not research these topics, they lump all paranormal activities together. DBV experiencers do not report the tunnel effect. They report time and time again that deceased loved ones are coming to take them away. And then what about the family members who have these experiences? And also, researchers, Oasis and Haraldson, and their research with thousands and thousands of nurses and doctors ruled out Blackmore's theories for the physical causes of the NDE, and especially the DBV. Some of the effects are similar because people share similar brain physiology. Here he goes again. For example, the tunnel effect. by those who comfort them during their travel to the other side. For the dying Christian, that might be Jesus. A Buddhist may see Buddha. For others, an angel, a beautiful woman, or Druid priest would bring more comfort. But she rationalizes, if I'm following a particular philosophy of religion, wouldn't it make sense for me to be visited at the moment of my death by an otherworldly escort who is familiar with my belief system? Okay, so he basically says that because I am suggesting that we have more to learn about these experiences, that we don't know everything that there is to know, that I am to be dismissed, basically. So on the one hand, his cohort, Blackmore, is saying all of these experiences are the same. When I point out subtle differences, this becomes fuel for the skeptics. Skeptics think they know and believe that they are experts in the unknown. I want you to ask yourselves, what does the word unknown mean? It means we don't have all of the answers. Perhaps, but of course, the simpler explanation is that people see what their expectations prompt them to see. This is his explanation. But my question is, what about those atheists who don't expect to see a thing? What do we say about the people who are lying on their deathbed? They have no wishful thinking. They're very at peace with the fact that they're just going to dissipate, that there's not going to be anything left. But then all of a sudden, they have a departing vision or a near-death experience, and they're totally blown away. And then he goes on, and that is the problem with the antidotal evidence for visitation. The experiencer's will to believe may override any temptation to critically examine the occurrence. Some proponents of the after-death contact adopt an in-justifies-the-means attitude. Okay, my question for him is, he isn't a psychologist, so how would he know whether any of the connections or feelings or appearances are true or not? I finally figured out it doesn't make a damn bit of difference. If it has any part in healing, who cares? This was a quote that was made by Vowell in 2001 in response to the skeptics who were basically saying, this is all just drugs, it's the end justifies the means, it's willful thinking, it's religion. The answer is that, first of all, and here is his response to this, people who value truth care. While magical thinking may be comforting in the short term, over time, estrangement from rationality can have consequences which may slide into ignorance and superstition. Okay, that was rich, wasn't it? So here's this person. Let's say you've got an atheist. I'm going to go back to the atheist. You have an atheist who is dying, and this person has made peace. And I've seen this on numerous occasions. They've made peace with the fact that they're going to pass. They're more concerned about their loved ones who are going to be left here. They don't have any wishful thinking. They don't have religion. They're not on medication. And they're not sitting there rationally trying to understand what is going on with them once they do have a departing vision. Usually when they do have a departing vision, it is such an overwhelming experience, they're typically pretty speechless. So who is Psychops? I'm not the only one they have trashed. Trust me, folks. They have stomped on everyone from Shirley MacLaine to bona fide academic researchers. I guess what I'm asking you to do, the loyal BBS listening audience, I'm asking you to be researchers yourself. When you watch these programs on television and you see these psychop skeptics talking about how none of this is true and giving all of these excuses for these experiences, don't take it at face value. Investigate. Start researching. Look around. Dig around. Investigate the researchers who are really, really looking into, okay, so what is the after-death communication? What is it? Is there a consistency? Look for consistency in these experiences. People who have departing visions, I will tell you, I did a radio interview this afternoon with a delightful radio show out of Cupertino, California, and one of the things that I shared with them was that I have collected departing visions from Japan, Australia, Poland, Mexico, and the theme is the same. The theme is that the dying are visited by someone they care about, a deceased relative or loved one, who is coming to comfort them and take them to the other side. Now, for you skeptics out there, I want you to explain that to me in physiological terms. How does the physiology of our brain set us up to have, at the moment of death, visions of deceased relatives who aren't coming to chew us out for past behavior, who aren't coming to share poetry with us or discuss politics or art? They come with one consistent purpose. In all languages around the globe, they come with a specific purpose to escort those who are preparing to die to some sort of afterlife experience. If you have an answer to that question, any of you, please feel free to email me. I would love to hear it. I have never, ever said that I know what happens to us after we die. What I have always said is that there is so much we do not know, and that some of the basic information, the tip of the iceberg information that we have today, doesn't begin to explain some of the spiritually transformative experiences that so many people are having. Yes, some are drug-induced. Yes, some are a byproduct of other experiences. But I can't believe that all of them are. So join us next time as we bust open the men behind the multimedia, paranormal, hating organization, the writers of the leading magazine devoted to destroying the credibility of paranormal research, the Skeptic's Bible, an altar at which they worship, the Skeptical Inquirer. Well, I'm off to a late night at the Hot Springs. Right up the road here, there's a Hot Springs, and I'm going to go soak my poor, sore body that was hiking for the last 2 days in the Hot Springs. And I hope all of you have an enjoyable weekend. And remember, if you have had an unusual afterlife contact, email me. Don't just put it aside. Don't just ignore it. Share it with somebody. Share it with a like-minded person. You can email it to me at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. And I look forward to hearing from you. If you're a skeptic out there, I'm going to say this again. If you want to have a reasonable conversation, that's great. But a lot of the email that I've received lately from you, it's been a lot of name-calling. Name-calling is not going to get us anywhere. If you have something really interesting to share, if you have an alternative theory that's worth looking into, I want to hear it because I'm open to that. So, people, sleep deep and dream well. This is Dr. Carla Wills-Brandon wishing you a good night.